I'm Todd Gleason for University of Illinois Extension with a history of Labor Day in the United States. It's adapted from a story found on the United States Embassy to Sweden's website. 11-year-old Peter McGuire sold papers on the streets in New York City. He shined shoes and cleaned stores and later ran errands. It was 1863, and his father, a poor Irish immigrant, had just enlisted to fight in the Civil War. Peter had to help support his mother and six brothers and sisters. Many immigrants settled in New York City in the 19th century. They found that living conditions were not as wonderful as they had dreamed. Often there were six families crowded into a house made for one. Thousands of children had to go to work. Working conditions were even worse. Immigrant men, women, and children worked in factories for 10 to 12 hours a day, stopping only for a short time to eat. They came to work even if they were tired or sick, because if they didn't, they might be fired. Thousands of people were waiting to take their places. When Peter was 17, he began an apprenticeship in a piano shop. This job was better than his others, for he was learning a trade, but he still worked long hours with low pay. At night, he went to meetings and classes in economics and social issues of the day. One of the main issues of concern pertained to labor conditions. Workers were tired of long hours, low pay, and uncertain jobs. They spoke of organizing themselves into a union of laborers to improve their working conditions. In the spring of 1872, Peter McGuire and 100,000 workers went on strike and marched through the streets of New York City demanding a decrease in the long working day. This event convinced Peter that an organized labor movement was important for the future of workers' rights. He spent the next year speaking to crowds of workers and unemployed people, lobbying the city government for jobs and relief money. It wasn't an easy road for Peter McGuire. He became known as a disturber of the public peace. The city government ignored his demands. Peter himself could not find a job in his trade. He began to travel up and down the East Coast to speak to laborers about unionizing. In 1881, he moved to St. Louis, Missouri, and began to organize carpenters there. He organized a convention of carpenters in Chicago, and it was there that a National Union of Carpenters was founded. He became the General Secretary of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America. The idea of organizing workers according to their trade spread around the country. Factory workers, dock workers, and tool makers all began to demand and get their rights to an 8-hour workday, a secure job, and a future in their trades. Peter McGuire and laborers in other cities planned a holiday for workers on the first Monday in September, halfway between Independence Day and Thanksgiving Day. On September 5, 1882, the first Labor Day parade was held in New York City. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
The following was recorded last week at the Farm Progress Show in Decatur.
Well, as we move into the noon hour, welcome to the University of Illinois tent here on the Farm Progress Show site. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason, farm broadcaster on WILL AM 580. More likely, you can pick us up as a podcast anytime, anywhere at WILLAG.org. We're going to talk with some folks from the American Soybean Association today. I'd say they're all in from St. Louis because that's where it is headquartered. However, you probably know as well as I do that leadership tends to be farmers, always is farmers, and they are spread across the nation. So we have both the president and the vice president of the American Soybean Association with us today. The president is Caleb Ragland. Thank you for being with us, Caleb. And then, of course, we have the vice president, Scott Metzger, with us. And the CEO, Steve Sinski, is with us as well. I think I'll start with the two of you and discuss maybe a little bit about your farms, where you farm, how you became involved in leadership in a farm organization. Caleb, because you're president, let's start with you.
All right. Well, thanks, Todd. I farm in central Kentucky, about an hour south of Louisville in LaRue County, which is home of Abraham Lincoln, which is something we have in common with
you
folks
bet.
In Illinois. He was born about 6 miles north of our farm. Farm with my wife Leanne and our three sons, Charlie, Corey, and Carter, they're all here, have enjoyed the proving grounds today and have been taking in the show. So they range from 15 to 10 in age. So a lot of fun. Got hopefully some future farmers coming along.
I bet you do. And then Scott Metzger, where are you from and what's your farm like?
Thank you, Todd. Yeah, myself and my family, we farm south central Ohio. We're about 40 minutes straight south of Columbus. Soybeans, corn, double crop beans is what we do. Have three children. The youngest, she's 14, and the oldest is 23. So they and then I got and then the one's a senior, so they keep me busy.
And then Steve Sinski is the CEO. Can you tell me about your background, please?
Sure, Todd. Great to be with you here today. I grew up on a farm in southwestern Minnesota, soybeans, corn, diversified livestock. But I've spent my career working in public policy space. Both up in Congress, working for a U.S. Senator from South Dakota, have served at the Department of Agriculture on three different occasions, and most recently as Deputy Secretary of Agriculture in the first Trump administration, but have been with the American Soybean Association a long time as well as their CEO, both before my stint going into USDA as well as afterwards.
I'd like to start, and I don't know which of you, I think probably Caleb, but priorities for the Soybean Association as it relates to policies at this point are what?
Right now, top of mind on policy is trade. We're obviously in a very difficult spot with China right now. They're 25% of U.S. soybean demand. And right now we have zero sales on the books due to this trade war we're in. And we are working tirelessly, both as farmer leaders and also our wonderful staff, to convey the message of how important trade is for our soybean farm families across this country. But trade is top of mind. We're also working on regulatory issues, biofuels, tax law, you name it. We have a whole lot of top issues, but trade is certainly top of mind at the moment.
Now, I have to ask both of you about where you think your soybeans go based on your locations. If you have a processor, I'm going to say Ohio may go to the southwest as opposed to out of the country.
Yeah. So currently, right now, most of our beans go to the southeast.
And get
crushed. But this upcoming year, we'll have our second plant come in. Louis Dreyfus is building a plant kind of north central Ohio. And actually, when it comes up and is fully under production, about 85% of the beans are actually going to stay in state now and will get crushed in state between that plant and the other soy crushing plant we have in the kind of northwest side of the state.
Louis Dreyfus crushing mostly for oil and biodiesel?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yep.
Or will they be looking for renewable diesel?
No, well, both.
Both.
And then,
probably biodiesel.
Yeah. And then a meal out of it too. But yeah, our state will it'll change a lot over the next couple of years with that plant coming on, just and the amount of beans that it'll need that'll be staying in the state versus stuff that's normally been going out.
And to be honest with you, I think you're far enough south, but maybe you ship to the Ohio River or to the Mississippi, but I'm thinking the Ohio.
Yes. On my farm, personally, beans that go to crush would normally go to Cargill in Owensboro, Kentucky, on the Ohio, not too far from where it dumps into the Mississippi. And they also have a biodiesel plant there and do a big crush. They also float some on down the river as well, but that's been a very good market for a long time for our area. And me personally, on my farm, we do some seed production as well, but we enjoy a very good basis most of the time due to that crush facility. It's about 100 miles west of where I farm. Trucking's a big part of where I farm, by part of the world.
It is a long way to truck, but worth it if the basis is correct.
That's right.
And because when is your harvest season? It must be fairly early, I would think.
Yes. On my farm, we didn't get into that. We're soybeans, corn, and winter wheat. Every soybean I grow is double crop, which is a bit unique. But corn shelling has started in our area. I hope to shell corn next week. And There's been a trend in recent years to plant some soybeans first. The guys are growing full season. And there are soybeans being combined an hour south of me now. And a lot of them as you get down into Tennessee, you know, farther. But soybean harvest is coming in September as you get my area and south more and more now. And then a lot of people shell their corn after. But we always on my farm get our corn first because we're no-tilling our wheat right back into the corn stalks middle of October. So from about 1st September through the first part of November, we are just nonstop because we're shelling corn, planting wheat, and then all of our double crop soybeans harvest in late October, early November normally.
I'm still setting the stage for the conversation I want to have, but this tells me that you're probably have good basis for both your corn, possibly early season shipments, and for your soybeans too, and that you are going out mostly export. I'm not sure about your corn, but mostly export, probably for both crops, I would think, and well protected because of where you are located in the United States logistically.
Yes, logistics is a big part of farming for us. Not anything we produce gets hauled at least 100 miles. We do have some markets to the east of some brown water Kentucky's famous for that that helps some of our producers that obtain contracts. On my farm, I don't. There's a lot of corn that is shipped into poultry markets in the deep south as well. So we load some rail and so forth. So it's kind of a unique area, but most of the corn ends up leaving the state.
I might have been on the Bourbon Trail once in Frankfort and watched corn being dumped there into a small pit. And it was just coming out of the field at that point. So good stuff for you.
Yep.
Good stuff for you. Okay, so you're to the southeast, probably to the poultry or pork producers in that area. How well do you think your market is protected from, unlike here, and certainly unlike your farmer friends that live in North Dakota,
right?
How well is your market protected from the trade dispute that's taking place at the moment?
You know, it's interesting. We've been talking about this a bunch in one of our group texts, and you know, normally a basis in our area around this time, going into fall harvest for beans and corn both, it's, you know, corn you'll be in that 20-cent range, and beans a lot of time it's 30 for fall delivery stuff. But it just about is double that right now, just in our area with it. And that's, you know, even this summer, we've got a local ethanol plant that we haul to, and you know, a lot of times it's not uncommon for it to be 40, 50, 60 cents over. You know, the best it's been much this summer has been about 10 or 15. So it is affecting it.
And your farmer friends in the Dakotas, North Dakota particularly, are probably telling you about $1.50 or $1.60?
The one guy that's, well, our chairman, Josh Gackle.
Josh.
Yeah, at his local elevator, it's right now the basis on beans is $1.35. I mean, that's hard for us from where we're at even to believe.
I've been on the Gackle farm.
We have too.
I've been on the Gackle farm talking about barley at that point.
Yeah.
However, ask him at some point if he goes back 10 years what his bases used to be.
Yeah.
And he's going to tell you a number that sounds like the number you just got.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah.
So it has changed because over that 10-year period, China developed such a big import of soybeans, not only from the United States, but from Brazil as well.
Correct, yeah. Yeah.
Which brings me to our export market and the kinds of things that really need to happen. And maybe we can talk a little bit about that with you, Steve, to begin with, about how the Brazilians coming into the marketplace, becoming the world's number one producer of soybeans, changed the United States' position on the global export market, and what the American Soybean Association does to talk about quantity and quality and reliability and those sorts of things.
Yeah, we certainly have seen a Brazilian production greatly expand. It has just really come up in terms of production over the years. You know, and part of that has been facilitated, unfortunately, by some bad trade policy decisions that have been made by the United States. I mean, obviously, people know that it started when, you know, we had great expansion to serve the Japanese market. It was really when Brazil got started in soybean production after we put embargoes on and limited our exports under the Nixon administration. And then, of course, we also saw a lot of expansion that happened in just recently in our 2018 trade war with China. That was a real incentive for them to not only expand their production like they normally have been doing, along with increasing world demand. They were adding acreage, they were clearing land, but it really provided an extra incentive for them to serve that China market. In the last trade war, when we were, U.S. soybeans were shut out of that market. And frankly, that's what we're beginning to see right now again. And that's the fear about the long-term damage that these kinds of trade policies will have. In that, once Brazil brings that land into production, they're going to continue to produce on that land. Not only soybeans, but they're going to be planting corn too, as their winter crop, their safrinha crop, and that's going to continue to haunt U.S. farmers for not years and even decades into the future. And so that's why we're really have been appealing to the Trump administration to prioritize soybeans and get a deal with China on soybeans to put it up there at the top of the list, along with jet airplanes and critical minerals and other things like that, because the long-term consequences for U.S. soybean farmers and agriculture overall are going to be pretty devastating.
Is the administration receptive?
Well, we just really, you know, we put out a Mayday call, a distress call last week, and we're certainly hoping that they will heed that. And we have to keep the pressure on.
Yeah, let me ask that about that Mayday call, because the Trump administration and President Trump famously said, if he wants to be in a trade war, I'll just pay my farmers in his first administration. My soybean farmers, I think, was the exact quote. And the MFPs came out of that. But that's not really what you want. And that's not what the Mayday call was about.
No. It was very much that we want markets and we want the China market because it is such a big import market for U.S. soybean farmers. And farmers want to receive their money from the marketplace, not from a government check. And the fact of the matter is that China is such a large market, it simply can't be replaced by other markets around the world. China imports more soybeans than the rest of the world combined. So think about that. You take all the other countries that are importing soybeans, they don't import as many soybeans as China does. And so when you take China out of the equation for U.S. soybean farmers, if we're not able to sell there because of retaliatory duties of 20% that price our soybeans 20% above South American soybeans, they're not going to be buying from us. And that has the long-term consequences again. Yes, farmers can receive a payment, market facilitation payment, and that may help try to keep them afloat or stem the blood loss, but it doesn't restore the market, and Brazil still expands.
So, Caleb, I was thinking about this, and this morning I had the ag economist on, Nick Paulson, who happens to be sitting here, made a comment that when something like it's much easier to convince somebody to buy your product than it is to convince somebody who stopped buying your product to start buying your product again. You have to do both at some point. The administration is going to work with China, but that means there should be other nations that might be available, but they won't make up quite likely for what the total losses are.
That's right. That's what makes China both so important and so complicated. Obviously, there's numerous other geopolitical issues, but we had a customer that was so dedicated before the first trade war, every third row of soybeans went to China, one out of three rows. Then we had that trade war, and we have never got back to that level, which backs up your point. Last year, we were around 25% of U.S. production, which would be one out of four rows. So we went from one out of three down to one out of four. What's the damage going to be this time? Even when we get things solved is our concern, because we've proven that due to policy that we aren't dependable and they have diversified away from us. The fact is, as an industry, we're constantly looking for opportunities to diversify our risk, to export to different countries, new uses, domestic biofuel use. There's lots of things, but we don't snap our finger and replace a 25% hole that's currently in our market. And that's why we're facing such challenging economic conditions right now, is because we've got that gaping hole that we can't just stick our thumb in and fix. You don't fix that with the MFP payment. We need the market. And we also need some of these exciting things that are coming down the line, such as increase in RVOs that can help. Continuous research that's going on, finding new uses. We have this soy-based foam they're using, I think, for firefighting, used 12 million bushel last year. But all these little things take time. Our other export customers, which are wonderful, they're very small compared to China. So they're the elephant in the room. We must find a way to work with them to avoid economic disaster in soybean country.
And then, Steve Sinski, as CEO, as you think about the marketplace, and you've been at this long enough to understand, I think, the difference between an internal or domestic marketplace without an export market and one that is only internal. I mean, it just doesn't work all that well, and it sort of spirals down.
It certainly does. And, you know, today we're exporting over 50% of our crop is exported overseas. And while we want to grow the domestic market, and there is great opportunity for growth here, whether it's through our livestock industry to produce meat to either consume domestically, but that means exports as well, to export to the rest of the world, or through biofuels, which is a great opportunity. The fact of the matter is that 96% of the world's population lives outside of the United States. And if we want to have growing demand, we have to be able to serve that market that's outside of the United States.
Caleb Ragland is the president of the Soybean Association. Vice President is Scott Metzger. And the CEO of the American Soybean Association is Steve Sinski. We appreciate you all joining us for the day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.